the district court in our case is bound to follow the decision of the Ninth Circuit.
Gay marriage advocates in Alaska applaud a federal court decision. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 7th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, photographing the world's polar regions to highlight climate change.
These animals need a fair shake. I mean, these animals are just trying to survive. And I don't think any animal is vicious. And we have to change how we perceive and how we connect with these species and ecosystems.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals struck down gay marriage bans in Idaho and Nevada today. The federal court also has jurisdiction over Alaska, where five same-sex couples are suing to overturn the state's ban on same-sex marriage. Joshua Decker is executive director for the American Civil Liberties Union in Alaska. He says the arguments Alaska's making to defend its ban are the same ones Idaho and Nevada made.
I don't see how anyone could read today's opinion by the Ninth Circuit and see how Alaska could have any leg to stand on in trying to defend its unconstitutional ban.
A state spokesperson says the Department of Law is reviewing the decision and declined to make someone available for an interview. Caitlin Shortell is an attorney in Anchorage who is representing the Alaskan couples who are plaintiffs in the lawsuit against the state. Oral arguments in the case are scheduled for Friday afternoon, but Shortell says the Ninth Circuit has given the Alaska court its marching orders.
The district court in our case is bound to follow the decision of the Ninth Circuit striking down pretty much identical laws banning equal marriage.
Shortell says she expects marriage equality to be a reality in Alaska soon. Alaska's gay marriage ban has been in place since 1998. The Institute of the North is in Nome this week for the fourth annual Week of the Arctic, bringing together policymakers and local shareholders to discuss short and long-term goals for America's presence in the far north. KNOM's Matthew Smith reports.
Balancing larger Arctic ambitions with more local and immediate needs, like running water and affordable energy, dominated the discussion Monday during the Institute of the North's visit to Nome for the fourth annual Week of the Arctic. Niels Andreasen, the executive director of the Institute, says the discussion was wide-ranging and admittedly ambitious.
For as much as the long list of infrastructure and needs is, it's not all going to get addressed through the work that we're doing.
Andreasen struck a realistic tone about the scope of issues in the Arctic and how they far outweigh the money and political will needed to accomplish them. After an early morning meeting with Nome Mayor Denise Michaels and heads of regional nonprofit Kuwerik, Native corporations like Sitnasauk, and other regional leaders, Andreasen opened up the floor of Nome City Council chambers to public input. Nome's Chuck Wheeler was the first to the podium, lambasting recent assessments that a deepwater harbor at Port Clarence near Brevik Mission and Teller wouldn't affect fish, wildlife, or other subsistence resources.
We own this land. The government's just the trustee. Number one priority is to protect the land, preserve it, enhance it. But when economic development comes and big money, they forget about that priority. To say there's no impact is asinine.
Focusing on energy, Gwen Holdman with the Alaska Center for Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks says for all the talk of Arctic ambitions and the very real concerns for preparedness as more ships transit Arctic waters, the central problem of affordable, sustainable energy is what will ultimately decide the fate of many Arctic communities, as well as the direction of Arctic development.
Energy is an issue that's going to underline any of the goals that you're trying to seek to accomplish here. When you're looking at infrastructure build-out, looking at oil spill response, all of that, I think that the role of affordable energy has been really underplayed in a lot of these conversations. I'd like you to kind of consider thinking about energy a little bit more broadly.
And Washington State Senator Kevin Ranker, attending as part of the Joint Oceans Commission, urged Alaska law and policymakers to expand the conversation about the U.S. Arctic beyond Alaska and to other Pacific states like Washington.
The Arctic needs a larger congressional delegation representing the Arctic. If we can get Washington congressional delegates and Washington state legislators to start thinking about why the Arctic matters for a local reason, those are really interesting drivers to start to elevate this dialogue beyond Alaska is the only Arctic connection.
The week of the Arctic Conference continued in Nome today with several workshops and a federal listening session. The conference moves to Kotzebue tomorrow and Thursday before concluding in Barrow on Friday and Saturday. In Nome, I'm Matthew Smith.
Unprecedented closures this summer kept fishermen from targeting king salmon in an effort to bring more fish to spawning grounds after several poor runs. The drainage-wide results showing how well the management worked are now beginning to arrive, and the state says the Kuskokwim may have achieved its critical Chinook escapement goal. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
John Linderman is the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Regional Supervisor with the state's Division of Commercial Fisheries. He says subsistence fishermen deserve a thanks for their sacrifices this summer.
The result this year was that we saw escapements overall compared to 2013, well, about double or a little bit higher than that. So much improved escapement this year compared to 2013, with many more escapement goals being achieved. However, two primary tributaries of the Kerguelen River at the headwaters of the Holitna, as well as the Kwikset River here in the lower river, their escapement goals were not achieved this year.
A preliminary report published last week says the drainage-wide escapement goal was likely met. Managers, however, are not committing until they've worked through all the data in the coming weeks.
So there's a chance that, yes, we can have achieved the goal this year. But the big wild card in that equation is the fact that two significant tributaries did not achieve their escapement goals. So it makes it that much more difficult. If it was a little bit more black and white, if a minority of goals were achieved or all goals were achieved, it'd be a little bit easier to try and draw any conclusions at this point.
Lisa Olson, the deputy director for the state's subsistence division, says work is underway for next year's planning.
Now is the time to start thinking about what would work for 2015, what did not work too well in 2014. And I hope that people in the area get involved.
Federal managers were in control of the Chinook fishery last summer after the Federal Subsistence Board took action to federalize the management. No one knows yet what will happen next year in terms of management, but Linderman says fishermen will likely see restrictions on par with this year.
It's an unfortunate reality of the current situation and the current poor abundance that the Kuskokwim Chinook run finds itself in, and there just isn't enough to provide for the demand that's out there with respect to Chinook salmon. So that is the current expectation, is that we'd expect to see the season start with similar restrictions of what we saw in 2014.
Subsistence fishing will likely be at the forefront at the Association of Village Council Presidents Convention, which is hosting a subsistence panel Tuesday afternoon. The forum will include Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell, AVCP attorney Sky Starkey, and federal manager Gene Peltola Jr., plus Victor Joseph, the CEO of the Tanana Chiefs Conference. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, planting 300 trees in a day at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
So our goal is, you know, not necessarily right away, but over the next few years to make sure that we replace those trees that are lost due to construction.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
For those who want to unseat U.S. Senator Mark Begich, one strategy has prevailed from the start. Bind him to President Obama and the Affordable Care Act. A new ad from Republican challenger Dan Sullivan is typical of that approach.
Mark Begich votes with Obama 97% of the time for Obamacare.
But Begich, in a new radio ad running statewide, is taking the politically risky tactic of embracing the unpopular law.
Before the health care law was passed, one-third of Alaskans who tried to get individual policies were denied for pre-existing conditions and other reasons.
The ad says Begich is working to fix the law and make coverage more affordable. Obama is especially unpopular in Alaska. A national polling firm last month found 56% of Alaskans disapprove of the job the president's doing, while a Dittman poll put the figure at 65%. The minute-long Begich ad never uses the words Obama, Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act. Communities across Alaska are voting in municipal elections today. They are electing city council and assembly members and weighing in on local ballot measures. Some Southeast Alaska voters will consider how to raise revenues and what to spend them on. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld wraps up what's on Panhandle community ballots.
At least a dozen ballot measures are going before Southeast voters. The city of Ketchikan, for example, wants the okay to raise money to replace aging water and sewer lines. That could sound boring, but it won't be if lines up to 50 years old break and spill their contents.
It's not a question of if that system's going to fail, it's a question of when it will fail.
That's Ketchikan City Manager Carl Amelon answering a council question during a meeting last summer. A pair of ballot measures would raise $10 million for the projects. Officials say the state will reimburse 70% of the overall cost. Councilmember K.J. Harris usually opposes bond issues, but not this time.
To me, this is a need. This is not a want. We have to have infrastructure.
Critics say the city already has too much bond debt. Petersburg voters face seven ballot issues, most addressing taxes. Four would change different aspects of the local senior citizen sales tax exemption. Two would limit the break to locals, while one would exempt only food and heating fuel. The last of the four would make plans to phase out the break. Municipal clerk Kathy O'Rear says if that measure passes, only those 65 and older by the end of the decade would be eligible.
So eventually the senior citizen sales tax exemption will sunset or go away.
Petersburg Sales Tax Committee member Lee Corio is okay with the residency requirements, but he's not fond of the overall approach, which will increase municipal revenues.
They'll just spend it. I don't want to give it to them. And I don't think most taxpayers want to just give them money unless there's really a justification for it. This is not the way to do it. We have bond measures if we have projects that we need to fund.
In Skagway, voters will be asked to approve a bond measure funding a new $12 million public safety facility. Skagway Mayor Mark Schaefer, at an August meeting, said it's an important need for the community's tourism economy.
The buildings we use now are wholly inadequate for the industry we serve. They're quite shameful, in fact.
A companion measure would increase Skagway's seasonal sales tax from 5 to 6%. That's expected to raise enough money to pay back the bonds, which are a type of loan. Critics are mostly concerned about the sales tax increase because it would raise prices for residents as well as tourists. Juneau has one ballot proposition in this election. It would create what's called an empowered board that could set budgets and raise revenues for the capital city's two swimming pools. Supporters say a stronger board could attract more swimmers and other users and help pay for needed repairs. Critics say the measure would put too much emphasis on one part of the community's recreation programs. This is Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau.
People here in Alaska and in much of this part of the Northern Hemisphere will get a chance tonight to see a total lunar eclipse, weather permitting. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it'll be another appearance of the so-called blood moon.
Fairbanks National Weather Service meteorologist Ben Bartus says there's a pretty good chance for sky watchers to see the eclipse here in the interior.
Tonight we'll have partly cloudy skies. Looks like pretty crisp out, so if you're going to step outside to see it, dress warm. We're looking at lows between 5 and 15 above overnight.
But you'll either have to stay up late or get up very early to see it. Fairbanks amateur astronomer Martin Gutowski says it'll begin around 1:15 Wednesday morning, but the totality of the Earth's shadow darkening the moon won't begin until around 2:25 a.m. The moon should be darkest just before 3, and the event will be over around 4:30. Gutowski says the moon's position in the sky will be about the same as the lunar eclipse that occurred earlier this year.
It'll be low in the
horizon like it was in April.
And like that earlier eclipse, Gutowski says the moon will again be orange or reddish, which is why it's called the blood moon. It appears that way because of the Earth's atmosphere, says Peter Delamere. He's an associate professor of space physics with the UAF Physics Department and Geophysical Institute.
Because of the Earth's atmosphere, the green and the ultraviolet light from the sun is filtered out. And the red is the least affected as it moves through the atmosphere. So not only is it not affected, but it also bends or it's refracted towards the Earth's surface. So as the light from the sun moves through the atmosphere and it is bent, it gets bent towards the location of the moon behind Earth.
In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
More than a dozen people gathered at the Alaska Airlines Center on Friday with shovels, wheelbarrows, and small potted trees in tow. All were on a mission, and none were afraid to get their hands dirty. Their goal? To plant 300 trees to take the place of some that were cut down during the many construction projects on the University of Alaska Anchorage campus. APRN intern Ashley Snyder has more.
The University of Alaska Anchorage has just completed two major projects, the Alaska Airlines Center and the Engineering Building, and recently started another, a new parking garage. Thousands of trees were cleared to make room for these buildings, but the university has implemented a no-net tree loss system so that for every tree lost, a new one is planted. So, on Friday, a group of students, faculty, and staff at UAA spent the morning planting new seedlings.
Okay. Do you guys want to come with us?
Sure.
Plant?
Okay. One of the leads for the event, Ryan Buchholz, business manager for facilities and campus services, says the math for the program is pretty simple.
We did a study several years back that it's about 445 trees per acre when we clear land for a construction project. And then that determines what our, quote, tree debt is. So our goal is, you know, not necessarily right away, but over the next few years to make sure that we replace those trees that are lost due to construction.
In the summer alone, the university has planted over 6,000 trees on university land in the Kenai Peninsula and Palmer. On the Anchorage campus, with winter fast approaching, there was little time to spare to plant the remainder of small birch and pine trees. Horticulturist Kara Monroe used her expertise to help the cause. She was happy to see the turnout of volunteers.
I was really surprised.
There's quite a lot of people.
Yeah. Called on the community, mainly students, to come in and help us out. And there's way more than I thought out here, so that's really cool.
Yeah, we're going through these trees awfully fast.
Yeah.
That was student horticulturist Omar Villafuerte working to further his education and help the environment at the same time. It didn't take long for volunteers to get the hang of digging, unpotting, planting, covering, and then repeating it for the next tree. But it was difficult work. Volunteer Kelly Dunnelly found it took a little extra elbow power at times to get the job done.
Yeah, there are more roots than you anticipate. The ground looks soft and you dig in and then you realize, oh, there's a root there and you gotta find another place or dig through it. It's great.
Once all 300 trees were planted, the volunteers, eating pizza, got to sit back and admire the trees. Future students will likely appreciate them too. I'm Ashley Snyder.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
National Geographic photographer Paul Nicklin has traveled to some of the most remote regions of the globe to document the effects of climate change. He has plunged into icy water and floated on sea ice to photograph sea mammals that rarely encounter humans. Nicklin worked as a biologist in Alaska before becoming a professional photographer. He says his love of the Arctic developed as a kid, growing up in a tiny Arctic village on Baffin Island in Canada.
you know, back in the 70s, we never had radio, we didn't have television, we didn't even have a telephone in this community. And so we got our groceries once a year by ship. So, I mean, a lot of these Alaskan communities can relate. And you become so immersed in that environment, you become so immersed in that culture. And for myself, all my entertainment, all my pleasure came from being outside. And the Inuit were my teachers. They taught me survival skills. They taught me how to hunt. They taught me how to survive on the land. And I never really realized how deeply ingrained that was in my sort of spirit, that until I left the North and went to university, and every second I missed the North. And I came back as a biologist and became frustrated with the whole scientific process. Working for the Canadian government is extremely slow and can be very ineffective. And we were collecting great data, but we weren't doing anything with it. And I thought if I could just bridge the gap between this good scientific work and the public, then now I have a chance to reach 100 million people with a story in National Geographic magazine, for example.
Paul, tell me about some of your most memorable photography expeditions in the Arctic. What stands out?
I've had so many incredible journeys. I mean, when I look at my images, people say, "What's your favorite photo?" Well, I don't really ever have a favorite photo. I have favorite moments that will stay with me forever. You know, on my deathbed, it's going to be not surrounded by covers of National Geographic, but it's going to be memories and hopefully friends and family. You know, for myself, for, you know, swimming with narwhals to find out that there really are these unicorns of the sea, and very few people have seen them. And it took me 10 years to get in a position that I could actually photograph them. It involved me buying an ultralight float airplane that I could fly off the sea ice. We flew 100 miles offshore, landed on a floating pan of ice. We were surrounded by 1,000 narwhals. Scenes that nobody else could even dream of or imagine, and that scenes of very few people besides the Inuit will ever get a chance to see, and to reach out and to be able to touch their tusks as they're blowing for air and photograph. Spending time with grizzly bears in Denali National Park alone, hiking with them. Or I was sitting in Denali one day, and I was young. I was 19 years old, and right in front of me were a bunch of dull sheep, and I heard noise behind me, and it was a big grizzly bear walking behind me. And I looked over to the left, and there was a wolverine running up the hill, and I had to pinch myself that all these things were going on at the same time.
You have also photographed in Antarctica. Tell us about your encounter with a female leopard seal there.
I'm always trying to dispel myths with my photography. It drives me crazy when I go into a bookstore in Alaska and it's like Death by Bear and Alaska Tales of Death, and every picture's got a bear on the cover that's, you know, snarling, and bears don't even growl like that. You know, maybe it's yawning, or maybe a trainer's making it yawn. A picture person takes a picture, and, you know, so that stuff just really irks me. And so I'm always, these animals need a fair shake. I mean, these animals are just trying to survive. And so to have, you know, leopard seals be, you know, the villain in 8 Below Zero and Happy Feet, and it's just this vicious monster. And I don't think any animal is vicious. And we have to change how we perceive and how we connect with these species and ecosystems. And if I want people to care about ice, I can't afford to have them thinking, oh, Antarctica, ice, oh, that's where those terrible monsters live. You know, I pitched a story to Geographic to go to Antarctica and get in the water with as many leopard seals as I could over a 6-week period, just to see if they were vicious or if they were misunderstood. And I was amazed. I mean, I was nervous jumping in the water this first day with a 1,000-pound female leopard seal that had just killed the penguin, and there's blood and guts in the water, and she was ramming the dead penguin under the hull of our little Zodiac. We're trying not to fall in the water. And that's when I had to get in. So I put my snorkel in my mouth, my mask, and my dry suit and weight belt, and jumped in the water. And right away, this 1,000-pound seal that's, you know, a head bigger than a grizzly bear's, you know, came shooting over to me, engulfed my entire head in her mouth in this big cobra-like threat display. And she kept doing these threat display lunges at me. But it never looked aggressive. It was kind of, if you look at a leopard seal, they have no scars on their body. So I think they're always communicating with these displays. And so she calmed down after 5 minutes, and then she went off and got a penguin and tried to feed me the penguin, and a live one. And then she realized I couldn't catch that, so she brought me tired penguins, nearly dead penguins, and she brought me dead penguins. At one point, I had 5 dead penguins floating around my head. She started to flip penguins onto my head. She defended me from other leopard seals when they came by. And she would come and sleep by my sailboat at night, and then in the morning when I'd go back out into the Zodiac, she'd be there waiting for us like a big excited puppy dog. We'd drive over to wherever we wanted to photograph her next to icebergs. She'd go off and get a penguin, and we'd do this song and dance. And this went on for 4 days before she finally realized that I wasn't going to eat a penguin. And I went from being terrified to laughing so hard and crying in my mask. It was tears of joy and water flooding in my mask. I was constantly clearing my mask, trying to just see this amazing thing going on in front of me. So it's something I'll definitely never forget.
You were adopted by a leopard seal.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, you can be anthropomorphic or anthropocentric on these types of encounters, but I really think that in her eyes, she was just trying to figure out what I was doing there. She'd probably never seen a human being before, and so, I mean, you're either breeding or you're feeding. So she thought, if she could just get me to accept a penguin, she would understand why I was there. And then I think it became such this urgent need to make sure I wasn't going to starve. You know, she was, all of a sudden, I think she went from figuring out what I was to trying to help me. You know, you don't want to be anthropomorphic about this stuff, but I don't know how else to think about it.
Give us some context about the change in the Arctic that you've seen in the time that you've been a professional photographer.
That's a great question. 20 years ago, you think of a place like Svalbard, Norway, that's only 700 miles from the North Pole. And it's, you know, historically been completely surrounded by ice all summer long. And so you have these big, you know, where you don't have shelves of ice, you've got massive glaciers, and then you've got the sea ice, and then you've got the pack ice, and it's all swirling around. And on that ice supports a huge population of polar bears, for example. 3,000 bears live on these ice floes, and they're able to feed on seals all summer long. Well, just think now 10 years forward to 2006, 2007, we're trying to photograph a story there. We had to keep putting the story on hold for 3 years because there was no ice to be found anywhere. And the bears were stranded on land. And not only was there not ice in the summertime, there wasn't ice there in the winter. I mean, these bears were finding little strips of ice along. So you think of, you know, seals and their igloos where they give birth to their pups in the ice. It's affecting them. It's affecting copepods and amphipods and polar cod. And it's affecting the whole food chain. It's not just bears that are being affected.
What are you or do you really hope to accomplish with the pictures that you take?
I mean, everybody has a role to play. The scientists, I mean, without science, my pictures don't mean a lot. They're more of my, again, my own emotional interpretation. But I think since the beginning of time, since the time of drawing paintings on cave walls, we are visual storytellers. You think of the Inuit culture, it's very visual, very creative, very artistic. I think that we've been beating people over the head with facts of climate change in the newspapers. You read about it every day. I think we become inundated with it, and I think we become numb to it. So I'm just using my photographs as constant reminders. And we are seeing a shift in people's perceptions about the change. Not only am I trying to inspire change, but I'm also trying to drive change with decision makers and influential people.
Photographer Paul Nicklin will talk about his work and show slides tonight at Atwood Concert Hall in Anchorage. The talk is presented by the Anchorage Museum. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Matthew Smith in Nome, Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C., and Ashley Snyder from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
And by BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.